we are joined by our friend writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Kimball.
You've been a busy man bringing Monument to its knees again. What, you 10 trips up and down the Monument?
Three today, 10 Saturday, 10 Sunday, with the park rangers watching me on the video monitor, and I think placing bets among themselves.
Have they become?
How many times my head would pop up at the top.
They're supportive, though, of your efforts, right?
They are pretty supportive at this point. I think, in terms of, unless there's a medical emergency, not really a lot happens inside the Monument. So I provide the sporting qualities, such as it is. And then they seem to have some kind of wager going together. Maybe they lost count because I came back down and one of them, with bated breath, leaned in and said, "How many was it?" I'm like, 10. And the other one's like, "Yes." So I think the other one won something.
We're going to talk about your book, Dark March, in just a moment, but I would be remiss not to get your thoughts on the Stanley Cup Finals. Bruins even up now at 2 games apiece with the St. Louis Blues. How do you think this shakes out with 3 games left, potentially?
I think the Bruins are going to be aghast at themselves if they let this series get away, which they are making a move to do exactly that. They should be at worst 3-1 right now, and they are the better team. I think the Maple Leafs in the first round were the better team than the Bruins, and the Bruins found a way to get through that series with some pluck and guile, but they are handing this team games, and they are letting them stick around. It's almost like a baseball team where you're up 5-2, right, and you keep constantly having runners on second and third with one out, and you don't add on to that lead, and then boom, before you know it, tying home run. And the ninth inning, that's kind of the way the series is going, and they cannot let it get away, and yet they seem to be trending in that direction. They're clearly the better team than this team. This opponent is almost like the modern-day version of that Cinderella, that Vancouver Canucks in 1982, that makes it further than they have any right to go. And this should be the absolute end of them, not a championship. So Bruins need to lock it down on Thursday night, I think, at home.
Hey, I wanted to mention to you that I had a listener reach out to our recent conversations with you about films and said, "I've watched 4 of the movies that I hadn't seen that you talked about with Colin, and I love them. Thanks for the great ideas."
No, we're hooking people up with recs.
Yes.
Recommendations.
No question about it.
Broadening the cinephile population of the world. That's good.
Now we need to get them to read, and we need to get them to start with your book that's celebrating, 6th anniversary, right?
It is. 6th anniversary, round about this time in early June 2013. My first book came out, and because obviously we didn't know each other at the time, can't go back in time and do the segment then, and I thought maybe it'd be fun to talk about it now, because I also know that you recently read it. And I think it's a book that is definitely unique.
Yeah, it is indeed. The book is called Dark March, Stories for When the Rest of the World is Asleep. What do you mean by that? Let's start right there with the subtitle.
First off, I don't really think of it as a story collection, because I don't tend to like story collections. I don't like things that feel like they're piecemeal, like they've been collated, like I did these things, they have my name at the top, let's jam them together. So what I wanted to do was tell stories that functioned within the totality of a book. I always think of it as a book, not a story collection, not a novel, but a work of fiction that's a book. And we all know that time when we are reading late at night, early in the morning, whatever that time is, this kind of in-between magical time. And we feel like we're going to pay the price for this in the morning. And erroneous, of course, as it is, you couldn't really be more erroneous. You have the feeling that you are the only person up in the world at that time with that book, because you have a special connection with that book. That's why you're bargaining with yourself, where you say, okay, 15 more minutes, or okay, 5 more pages. And you keep going deeper and deeper into the night on this magic carpet ride of a book. And that is what I wanted this book to be for readers. And I think that's what it ended up being for them.
Well, it is certainly. And when I read it a few months ago, I couldn't put it down. And I was reading it when the rest of the world was asleep. And you grabbed me right from the get-go with the opening story, The Spit, as an island becomes sentient. And man, what an incredibly original idea, and it just pulls you right in.
It introduces one of the prevailing moods of the book. And what I wanted to do was to document the absolute essence of human heartbreak. I wanted to distill the most pain we can feel from having our hearts broken, because I think everyone has their version of that in a book. And yet I didn't want it to be this hideous kind of labored experience. So this heartbreak is transmuted into these different kinds of stories. And the first story is about a spit of land. And a spit of land is exactly what you think it is. It's kind of like connected to the land, and it hooks out into the water, whether it's a river or lake, ocean, whatever it may be. And there's this kind of geological controversy where it seems that this spit might actually, in fact, technically be an island. And this is going to be reassessed by scientists and everything. And so this wise-ass gull who eats his daily breakfast crab on this spit, he shows up. And this crab says, look, man, you're free now. You technically don't have a classification. You're off the grid. You can be whatever you want to be. And this is really appealing to the spit, although everyone knows not to trust this particular rock crab who is always up to no good. And you learn about, like, his dicey business schemes and everything that involves sea urchins. And so, really, the rock crab wants to kind of live vicariously through this unclassified form of nature, because the rock crab is just a rock crab. And the rock crab has heard tell of this place called the Edge. And he lies, and he says that he's gone to the Edge, and he's had a spree, and he's really lived it up. But he wants this spit or island to go in his place, report back to him, and he can kind of get his jollies through that. And so it doesn't quite work out the way that the rock crab wants it to. But I think it sounds that note of, ironically, a very human story that has very few humans in it. And I think that's the key idea of this book, because I don't like surrealism. I don't like Salvador Dali and melted clocks and all of that stuff. I like human emotion and experience and how we all relate to that. And that's what I wanted to provide people with this book. But you can take human emotion and human experience and you can put it into all sorts of different things. That's why we sometimes see with ghost stories that it's dealing with the dead, people who are not humans anymore, and they can be so human. And so in this case, these creatures, this land, these structures, they're very human. And it signals this note, too, that you're in this kind of different world. You're in, like, an early Disney world. You are in a Star Wars world. You're in an Alice in Wonderland world. But it's going to be even more human than those things. And it's going to be, again, your magic carpet ride off to somewhere else. And also into your own heart, into your own experiences, where you think back on that thing that's happened to you that was kind of the defining pain of your life and be like, okay, I connect with this. And yet it's whimsical and it's funny and it moves me forward. And it's not just beating me about the head with my pain, although I recognize this pain from my own life.
Well, it's interesting because one of the stories that I was really drawn into, and I read it, I think, 3 times, I kept going back to it, and it was Incident at 7,000 Hertz. I don't know what it is about that story, but I couldn't stop. I had to keep going back to it.
Now, that's a story where a voice has its own identity. And the voice, it's like the voice is an entity that has a job. And it just happens to be in the employ or working within this factory, this place of business of the person. It is housed in. And the person in the story is doing things and saying things, basically giving the voice its marching orders, and the voice is not keen on going along with it. And when a voice rebels, you basically lose any job that you might ever get again as the actual audible quality that comes out of somebody's mouth. And this voice is conflicted and has to make a decision that involves going over a certain volume threshold. So again, we're in these human stories because what's playing out with the person that the voice lives within is wrenching. and what that person is doing to another person is wrenching. And the voice wants to be enwrenched from this particular situation and has that decision to make.
We're talking with Colin Fleming about his book, Dark March, Stories for When the Rest of the World is Asleep. My wife's family has a place down at MDI, Mount Desert Island, and spent some time down there in the summer, as I have forever, being a native Mainer. And the summer people, the moneyed people who have been there for generations, they get, is it safe to say, a comeuppance of sorts in the incredibly captivating story, Lobby Lobsterson?
Lobby Lobsterson is the story. It was actually the first one that I wrote for this book, and it involves a man who has a keychain, and, you know, decorative keychains that you get at, like, these trinket shops on places where seaside, right? They're by the harbor, they're by the piers, and you get, like, ice cream, and you get, like, oh, we're going to get this kind of keychain for the year, that type of deal. And on the keychain is embossed this little lobster. And this lobster on the keychain is going to torment the man. It's going to abrade through his pocket, basically, and cut into him. And he has this decision to make where he's lost his wife. And the last contact that they had, in a sense, was a paper bill, money. And he realizes that's probably the last time he's going to have any kind of contact with her. And he doesn't know what to do with that, to keep it, to rip it up, to get rid of it. And meanwhile, he has this lobster as his conscience, basically, that he wants to get rid of, that he can't bring himself to get rid of. So it's almost like the rock crab of the first story, who's now gone into lobster form, and it's a different kind of torment being acted out. And all of the stories really are like that. There's one where a man comes home from a kind of war, and the shed behind his house is encased in blue crystals. In another story, a fellow has his house get shorter every day as his basement gets deeper. And again, it's that notion of whimsy, that kind of ensorcelled magic. Yet at the same time, I don't know of a book that codifies human pain more intensely. And I think of something like Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, where it's kind of the musical version of this book, where he said to somebody, I don't know why you would listen to that record, why you would dig that kind of pain. And that's kind of a nudge and a wink sort of statement, because the reason you'd listen to it is because Dylan had the sense to use melody, to use tunefulness, to help that extremely intense emotion go over. And in this book, it's humor. And it's a very funny book. I think it's as funny a book as I've read, and as heartbreaking a book. And I was looking at it today before coming on, and it's almost from long enough ago now that I don't feel like it was something I did. So I'm almost reading it as a third party. And there are pages where I am both about to cry, like I've been triggered by something, and then I'm about to cry from laughter. And I really don't know what other book does that. So I think it's in that Blood on the Tracks mode, but again, it's completely different. It's very Alice in Wonderland. And at times, if you were a foul-minded high school student, it's very fun and quotable in that sense. But the reality, the pain, that resonance, it sneaks up beside you and says, hello, I am here. Remember that time this happened to us? And I think it's something that's easy for people to relate to.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is that the common thread among these stories, is the universality of that pain and the differences in how we all deal with it and process it?
I think it is. And the thing about pain, when we, and everyone listening right now, do a little experiment with me. Think about the most painful thing that's happened to you in your life in terms of loss. Now, you probably view that as like the knee plus ultra of pain. We all do. That's how we all regard the thing that's happened to us that is the most painful. We do not think it takes, and it's not an arrogance thing, it's a human nature thing. We do not think it takes a backseat to other pain that other people have had. So if you've gone through something that maybe isn't that bad at all, you don't think it's that way. And if you've gone through the worst thing ever, you think it's the same way as the person who has gotten off easier than you have. That's the great binding agent that is human suffering, that is pain, is that it's like retrofitted for our respective psyches, hearts, and souls. And I realized this as I was writing this book, that I was going to a place that I had been put into in my own life. And I was writing from, I had, I think, as much pain as that at the time, erroneously, I thought that I could have. And I said to myself, like, look, you can write from inside this pain. When you write from inside pain you are in and you create outward, you move through different levels and walls and fields and forests of other experiences that are so removed from your own that you end up with stories about bits who want to be islands and dastardly rock crabs, even though you have really pinned down the crux of human suffering. So when you have that blend, you're doing something artistically that is so creative. I would imagine as you looked at some of these stories, you thought to yourself very simply, how did he come up with this?
I did.
What makes this go into somebody's brain? And at the same time, you're also going back into your own life and you're thinking about your own experiences and you're seeing yourself in these stories, in this book. And I think that is what really is something that makes it powerful and that, you know, gives it that chance to last.
Is it bad that I connected most of all, I think, with a hermit crab?
Oh, the hermit crab is pretty, that's pretty, it's like this learned hermit crab, but he's a hermit crab. So you can't go to the library of your hermit crab unless someone like generously brings you a new terrarium and just puts you down on a table. And so scraps of books or paper or the back of like labels from salad dressing, they filter into the ocean. And so the hermit crab, he's getting society, but sort of like one chopped sentence or ingredient list at a time. And the other, his cronies, his friends, his peers, his patriots, they just think he's the stage. They think he's like Yoda. He goes around fencing like he's so above everybody. And he's dealing with this, I think it's a different crab and or a gull. And he says to the gull, he's like, you're an idiot. Enjoy your slough of despond. So he's quoting this poem, but he doesn't even understand. The other animal's like, damn, that guy, he is formidable. And, of course, he's doing what a lot of people just do, like that kind of uncle who comes up to you at the family cookout, and he's like, yeah, so I was like, Chara, you just should, like, wire your jaw shut. It'll make you look even more fierce. And he just says things, and you're like, all right, that's cool. That's a great idea. And he's like, yeah, I'm really a brilliant guy. I'm a sport Socrates. So that's what the hermit crab is. And, again, but what would happen, though, later on that page, or certainly by the next page, is your solar plexus would be absolutely kicked in by something you couldn't see coming, and you'd be like, damn, I need to either cry for a bit or take a walk around the block because that has absolutely undercut me. Did not see that coming. And life is like that. Life is the sacred and the profane. If you've ever been in the hospital when a loved one is dying, you're in the waiting room and there is a group of people assembled, your family and your friends or whatever. People still tell jokes and people still laugh. That is still something that happens while the dying is being done. And I think there's a metaphor in life for that. And it's a metaphor that was blown up into book form and unique book form in this particular book.
Get it, read it, you'll love it. Dark March, Stories for When the Rest of the World is Asleep by Colin Fleming. By the way, I want to mention too, Colin, you're going to be back with us on Friday. You're going to sit in from afar and help me talk with the folks behind this brand new documentary called The Russian Five.
I am like a radio-shaped boomerang, and I will be coming back because I do love Russian and Soviet hockey and big historian with all of that, written about that a lot, and we've talked about it on the radio, and I find that period very fascinating, and also we'll be talking about the film where these players were the ones who really had the best chance to succeed in the NHL, and they had in part the best chance to succeed, not just because what had happened politically at the time, but that they were all together, and it was a special situation where they weren't scattered across the league. It was the Detroit Red Wings, and they were set up for success, and they helped make the Red Wings one of the best sports franchises of the last 25, 30 years.
No question about it. Looking forward to it on Friday. Thanks, Colin. We'll catch up with you then.
Okay, my friend.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown.